Pronounced Ron Christie from the University of Sussex. And Ron, pretty nice to address that second question in our list, which is just what is it that philosophy and psychology, so research into cognition and perception, what can they get from doing experiments with psychology?
Thanks. Yeah, and thanks for. Where's Tom? There. Thanks for inviting me to speak here. I'm sorry, I'm a bit hoarse. Not sure why. But I'm going to talk about that and a little bit about, I think it was question number one. But anyway, you can look at my position statement to see how they match to the questions. I won't mention the questions explicitly here. So you'll warn me when I have 5 minutes left or something. Great. Okay, let's see if we can get this to work. Great. Okay, so here's an overview of what I'll be talking about. Three things. The first thing is I'm going to look at how sensory augmentation research might assist in something that I call prosthetic artificial consciousness. I'm going to propose that everybody here who's doing research into sensory augmentation or sensory substitution even is actually doing something that could really help in this endeavor that I'll explain later. The second part of the talk will be about some foundational issues concerning what are sensory modalities anyway and how can we individuate them. And lastly, I'll talk about why these issues matter to me and my research, and two sub-parts to that. Very quickly, a topic called synthetic phenomenology, which I think is about how is just one way that sensory augmentation research could assist in a science of consciousness. But also on a more philosophical talk about how sensory augmentation or substitution can assist in doing philosophy, and that's a position I call interactive empiricism. Okay, so part one. What is prosthetic artificial consciousness? Well, there's this field called artificial consciousness, or sometimes called machine consciousness, which is just the attempt to build artifacts that either have conscious states, or by building these artifacts, you attempt to understand natural conscious states. So the artifacts might not themselves have conscious states, but they still might, building them might help you understand consciousness. And for this enterprise, I'm part of this community of machine consciousness, artificial consciousness. If there's a new journal out, just the first issue of the journal is just appearing soon, called the International Journal of Machine Consciousness. So there's a growing interest in this field. And there's a problem in this field, which is there's a gap between the third-person enterprise of engineering and the first-person aspects of consciousness, which are really the subject of the discipline. And in particular, how is this approach supposed to work? How could building stuff, which is this third-personal activity, illuminate or create things with first-personal states? How could you tell whether or not you've succeeded? How can you measure progress? So there is this epistemological problem, which I can't really go into a lot of detail motivating, but I hope you can see the general problem. There's a distinction that one can make in trying to do artificial consciousness between autonomous artificial consciousness and prosthetic artificial consciousness. And autonomous artificial consciousness is the kind of let's build Commander Data kind of thing. Let's build a robot, an artificial creature that has conscious states. That's an interesting goal, and I'm sure attempting it will tell us a lot about consciousness. But there's another approach that people in the artificial consciousness community or machine consciousness community could take, which is prosthetic artificial consciousness, and that's the approach of creating new experiences by altering or extending the agent-based processes that enable them in systems that are already naturally conscious. So we're using technology to alter or extend experiences in, say, humans. And I think that can still be continuous with the artificial consciousness or machine consciousness methodology and goals of trying to understand consciousness by having some kind of control over the substrates of consciousness and being able to systematically alter them and study the effects. And we can study the effects in a way with prosthetic artificial consciousness, we can study the effects in a way that we can't study them in the case of autonomous artificial consciousness, because we can ask the person how their conscious experiences have been altered, or we can, for instance, we know human psychology well, so we can, in addition to asking them, use other kinds of probes. So machine consciousness in the autonomous sense, artificial consciousness that's autonomous, has this big epistemological gap. Prosthetic artificial consciousness can close this gap at least somewhat. At least it doesn't have exactly the same problems. I think its problems are more tractable than those of machine consciousness, autonomous machine consciousness. So I say in a recent paper, artificial consciousness might contribute to our understanding of consciousness as much by systematically altering or extending consciousness as by replicating it. So the idea here is that any of you out there who are designing sensory augmentation devices or sensory substitution devices, you really are engaging in prosthetic artificial consciousness. You might not have realized that, but you are. And therefore, I think you have a lot to contribute to and also benefit from engaging with the community of artificial consciousness and contributing to and reading the journals in that field, etc. So I think there's a lot of possible cross-pollination here. That's a potential cross-pollination that isn't going on yet as that much. It could be a lot better. So I'd look forward to that. Part two now is about some foundational issues in sensory augmentation research. What is sensory augmentation anyway? I think Malika and Andy's talks are very useful in this regard, and I just want to continue the discussion that went on there. So prior even to asking what is sensory augmentation, we can ask, well, what is a sense modality and what is perception? And you might think, well, come on, philosophers can't be that well. Maybe you do realize that philosophers persist in asking the simplest questions. But what is perception is actually still a controversial issue. I mean, I was... And not really having a clear answer to that question of what is perception can lead to some problematic views. So I was at a conference last week in honor of the late Susan Hurley, and the last speaker of the conference was a philosopher that I respect immensely, Ruth Millikan, and she presented a view in which she claimed language is a form of direct perception of the world. So when somebody tells you there's some music playing in the lobby of IDS, they tell you that here. According to Ruth Millikan, because you understand language, you have actually perceived that there is music playing in the lobby of IDS right now. Matter of fact, you heard that there is music playing in the lobby of IDS. Now, I think I don't have time to go into the problems with that position. I think it is a problematic position. I think it's violating our intuition that, you know, when we hear the music by being there, that's what it means to hear music playing in IDS. When somebody tells us that using language, we get the information, but we wouldn't count it as hearing the music. We heard that there is music playing, but we didn't hear the music itself. So I think that wouldn't count as a case of perceiving the music. We perceived, maybe in some strange indirect way, that there is music playing there. Now, how can you resist that kind of problematic view that you don't really have time to do justice to or go into detail about the problems of? Well, I think what's wrong with that picture is a failure to distinguish between two kinds of content, sensory content that go on in perception. There's the conceptual content of perception, which is sort of like the facts that you get through perceiving the world. And then there's the non-conceptual content, which is more has to do with, in traditional terms, you'd say it's the what it's likeness. The temptation is to start talking about qualia, but it's different from qualia in that it's still content. It's still about the world. It still can be true or false, right or wrong. It's just that it's not the everyday. They aren't facts in the sense of the everyday facts that we talk about, like whether or not there's music playing in IDS, but more like facts about our sensory surface and sensory motor expectations of what kinds of reflectances our visual system would expect to receive if a particular move were made, a particular muscle contraction was made, very fine-grained kinds of content that don't yet get to the level of objects and properties that we talk about when we normally talk about propositional, conceptual content. So the idea that maybe you could stop this crazy view of Millikan's and get a better idea about what perception is by saying that perception is a special case of when the non-conceptual contents of your experience are, they're related in a special privileged way to the conceptual contents of your experience. When I'm actually hearing the band playing in IDS or hear the music playing in the lobby of IDS, I do get the conceptual fact, hey, there's some music playing, but I do it by virtue of having experiences with non-conceptual content of a particular sort that relates to that fact. Whereas when I just hear somebody tell me that, the non-conceptual content of that experience has to do with the sound of their voice, and or maybe somebody wrote it on a real whiteboard. Maybe they wrote it there. There's music in the lobby of IDS. You're welcome to attend. The non-conceptual content of that experience has to do with marks on a whiteboard and visual content. It doesn't have anything to do with the relationship between that non-conceptual content of what it's looked like to see that whiteboard and the fact that there's music playing in IDS is very different than the relationship between the non-conceptual content I experience when I'm actually in that room listening to the music. I think these kinds of issues are going to be very useful thinking about this relation that is the perception relation. It's going to be very useful for understanding when a particular technology is providing sensory augmentation or sensory substitution or something else. But I really don't have too much time to go into that proposal. So Andy said some things about sensory modalities I found very interesting, very useful to think about. So this is my summary of some of the things he said at one point in his talk. He said there's this qualia-based view of sensory modalities that is the view that there's a principal distinction between them. And then one idea is that maybe we should stop trying to really look for a sharp distinction between sensory modalities and instead adopt a content-based view of perception where really perceptions and sensations are really exhausted by the content that they provide to us. And really there's no kind of sharp distinction between such contents. Andy put this forward rather tentatively, I think. Maybe the distinction between these contents is only a matter of degree, and therefore there's really no real objective distinction between sensory modalities or in any sharp sense. I think maybe we could reject that dichotomy between qualia-based views of experience and content-based views of experience. I tend to agree with Andy that content's the way to go, and talking about qualia is very problematic. But I think even when you try to understand perception as purely content-involving, that is, putting some condition on the world, rather than these ghostly things that can't be scientifically investigated, qualia, I still think you can make sense of a principled qualitative distinction between sensory modalities on that content-based view without having to embrace the problematic notion of qualia. So how could you make sense of this? How could you find principled distinction between perceptual contents that reconstructs, at least to some degree, our intuitions that there are sharp distinctions between sensory modalities? Well, one idea might be that you can cluster together perceptual contents according to a relation you might call imaginative or epistemic closure. So if possession of all the rest of these sets of perceptual contents enables you to know what it would be like to have the other one that you haven't had before, then that would suggest they're all in a clump. Whereas if possession of all of these perceptual contents, that is, knowing what it would be like to have an experience of that perceptual content, doesn't by that very fact give you the ability to imagine what it's like to have one of these perceptual contents, then that suggests they're different sensory modalities. Yeah, it's on the next slide. This is a technical version of that. So a set S of contents are in the same modality if and only if, for all the contents in that set, knowing the rest of the contents in that set would give you the ability to know what it's like. Knowing what it's like to have all the rest of the contents in that set would give you the ability to know what it's like to have that one that we've left out. So if there's this closure relationship between them, then that suggests they're the same modality. So intuitively, let's talk about auditory contents and visual contents. If you could know what it's like to have every kind of visual experience except for this one particular take one particular visual experience of, say, a particular shade of blue, to use an example from history of empiricism. It's plausible that somebody who, if you know what it's like to have all the visual experiences except for that particular shade of blue, that will imply that you'll have the ability to know what it would be like to have that particular shade of blue experience. But also intuitively, Having the ability to imagine what it's like to have all those visual experiences won't help you at all to imagine what it's like to have a particular visual experience, any visual experience. Auditory experience. So that's the intuition, is that the people who have never had any visual experiences find it very difficult to imagine what it would be like to even have one visual experience. All their auditory contents don't help them in that. So it's just a first pass at how you might make a division between the sensory modalities by looking at relations between clumpings of perceptual contents. That's not the main point of this talk. It's just meant to give an example of how we might proceed in this area without being forced to choose dichotomously between either content-based views of perception or qualia-based views of perception. Okay, well, why do this? Who cares? Why should we care about coming up with distinctions between the modalities? Why does this matter? Well, I think one reason why it matters to me in the case of science is that I'm interested in the science of consciousness. And one thing that you have to do when doing a science of consciousness is come up with a precise way of specifying the contents of conscious experiences. To specify, if you want to have a science of something, you better specify the thing that you're trying to explain very precisely. And also, you want to use experiences to explain, for instance, behavior. So you want to be able to precisely specify experiences if you want to give precise explanations of behavior. So if we're going to develop means of precisely specifying experiences, then one way to do that is a technique that I call synthetic phenomenology. Okay, my remote's not working. Right, so synthetic phenomenology is a particular way of specifying experiences precisely, using artifacts to assist you in that. That might seem a strange idea, and I don't have time to elaborate on it in detail, but previous examples of synthetic phenomenology that I've focused on in my research have been using the states of robots presented in a particular way to the scientist as a way for the scientist to know which conscious experience that robot is modeling. Well, another idea is to instead use different kinds of technology, not robots, but use sensory augmentation technology to assist you in specifying the contents of experience. For instance, the range of experiences that any given scientist might be able to have is a subjective matter about them, and yet the science of consciousness should aspire to be objective. So by using sensory substitution and sensory augmentation, we might allow, using technologies like that, we might allow a scientist to grasp a broader range of experiential contents, know which content is being explained or specified in a science of consciousness. So that's a way in which these devices might assist in a science of consciousness. I want to quite quickly move on to the last topic. Now even the keys on my computer doesn't work. Okay, so the last issue is how sensory augmentation relates to philosophy. And philosophy is, I don't have time for all of these slides, I'm running out of time. So philosophy is basically, and the view that I'm assuming here, is conceptual analysis and works with a stock set of concepts, basically a static set of concepts, and it analyzes them and tries to find conceptual dependencies between them. So on the traditional view of philosophy, there's a sharp distinction between philosophical inquiry, which is a priori, and scientific inquiry, which is a posteriori, that is empirical. And so on the traditional view, you have this set of basic concepts, and the way you make philosophical progress is you create new propositions out of them and find new dependencies between the concepts that maybe you weren't aware of before. Well, there are limits to that. I think some conceptual problems, so philosophical problems, can only be solved not by just recombining the concepts you already have and coming up with new propositions that are expressed in terms of that basic stock, but by coming up with new concepts. And traditional analytic philosophy doesn't really talk about that at all, about how to come up with new concepts of a subject matter. They only they talk about what you can do given a particular static set of concepts, what you can do with them to manipulate them in order to come up with illuminating answers. But sometimes the answer will require a new concept. So we need a different methodology. And what I have suggested before is that we extend the philosophical method by coming up with techniques using technology to give us new kinds of experience that will give us new concepts that will allow us to solve old philosophical problems about perception, consciousness, etc. So this is different from traditional empiricism, which says everything, every idea, every concept must be based on experience of the world. It's saying, not only do acquiring concepts require experience, but it requires a particular kind of experience, a kind of interaction with a subject matter, in a way that's, for those who are aware of what goes on, say, in there's a cognitive science example of cat vision developing. Kittens can only develop the ability to see if they interact, if there's an interleaving of their actions and sensations of the right sort. Well, I'm making an analogy between that and the right concepts of, say, consciousness. You can only have the right concepts of consciousness. You can only be able to see the critical conscious phenomena as a scientist of consciousness if you have the right kind of experience of the relation between your interventions and the results of your experimentation. So I'll skip this. So what Aaron and Sloman and I said in 2003 was that replication or even modeling of consciousness in machines requires some clarifications and refinements of our concept of consciousness, and design of, construction of, and interaction with artificial systems can itself assist in that conceptual development. Well, this is to emphasize autonomous artificial consciousness, but going back to the very beginning of the talk, what I'd like to say is also prosthetic artificial consciousness can play a similar role here. So Sloman and I didn't think about that in our example in 2003, but the same process applies. The idea, if you build prosthetic artificial consciousness devices, that might allow you to develop your concept of consciousness. So I'll skip this. There's a talk on the web that I would, if you're interested in this issue of interactive empiricism, which is very closely related to some of the issues that Tom was talking about, only I'm more interested in the particular way that and challenges that are involved in transforming concepts, that in particular, how prosthetic AC can help us do that and sensory substitution can help us do that. If you're interested in it, there are some talks of mine on the web that are mentioned. There's a link in the abstract booklet. I'm trying to move on, but my computer is not lying. I think the inactive torch is an example of a device that can let us do this kind of conceptual development. And these are the last two slides. You might have been involved in the empirical study that was going on that we were conducting with the inactive torch. The idea there is we want to empirically measure the extent to which experience with a sensory substitution device like the inactive torch can result in a change in your concepts of perception. And so we asked subjects, we gave statements to subjects, as many of you know, and asked them to indicate their degree of assent or dissent from the statement. And that was both before and after they used the inactive torch. And the idea is that we can look at their responses and maybe in some cases see evidence of a change in their concept of perception, and maybe correlate that with other data that we took about the use of the device. Maybe certain modes of using the inactive torch will be more indicative of a greater change to your concept than others. The last slide is just talking about some problems in this. How can we measure change in a concept? If what I said before was true, then you can't just ask people, how has your concept of perception changed? Because if they can linguistically express the change in their concepts, then really that's a case of the propositional conceptual change that I said isn't sufficient for resolving some resolving some conceptual problems in philosophy. But rather, maybe we can ask them questions, but look for the non-propositional effects on their responses. So not just what they say, but how quickly they say it, or the degree of confidence that they express in what they say, or the degree of assent or dissent in what they say. So here we're bordering on, we're engaging in a field called experimental philosophy, and trying to see. I'm not so sure. It's more like experimental psychology of philosophy. It isn't philosophy itself, but it's more studying how philosophical views, that is, your stock of concepts involved in philosophy, might change as a result of particular interactive experiences. So that's it. Thanks.